Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, what Washington could do about high drug prices and why they haven't so far.
And the reality is, and I don't think it's just unique to AbbVie, is that prices vary dramatically around the world. There is no question, at least in AbbVie's business for the most part, the U.S. has some of the highest prices in the world. That's not universally true. If a market at the size of the United States were to collapse to the lower end of that pricing model, then I can just tell you AbbVie would not be able to invest the level of R&D that it invests today.
If our pipeline will not deliver on the promise.
Those are the voices of some of the men who lead the country's largest pharmaceutical companies. They were on Capitol Hill late last month to answer questions about why drug prices are so high. Here's a couple examples. If you take Humira for rheumatoid arthritis, you may know that it has a list price of $60,000 annually and that that price has doubled in the last 5 years. If you take Lyrica for pain, which is made by Pfizer, you probably know that the listed price has also doubled in the last 5 years. The CEOs said those high prices are necessary to pay for research and development. But Democrats and Republicans, candidates for president, even the president, are skeptical. So what can be done about it? Two guests and your experience. Do the prices of the drugs that you take have an effect on your household budget? Why do you think Congress hasn't addressed something that a majority of Americans say they want action on? I'm interested in your experience with your own prescription drugs, if they have an effect on your household budget. Maybe some of the things that you do to make the medicine stretch or to sacrifice in other ways to pay for your pharmaceuticals. And then I'm interested in an overall larger question about why you think Congress hasn't addressed something that a majority of Americans in polling, in campaigns, in many different ways have said they want Congress to act on. Here's the number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. On Twitter, at CarrieNPR. Dr. Waleed Jalad is director of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Pharmaceutical Policy and Prescribing. He's an associate professor of medicine, and he's with us today from Pittsburgh. And Dr. Jalad, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
David Mitchell is with us. He's a founder of Patients for Affordable Drugs. And David, welcome to you. Good to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me.
David, I know this is not just an academic debate for you. You rely on drugs to treat your blood cancer. And I want to ask you the question that I'm asking our audience, which is, how do you deal with the rising prices of these medicines that you take, and how does it affect your household budget?
I buy very expensive Medicare supplements. I'm very fortunate to be over 65 and have access to Medicare. But in order to make the drugs be affordable, I have to spend a couple of $1,000s a year in addition. That helps me with the out-of-pockets. The drugs I'm taking right now to control an incurable blood cancer carry a price tag of $325,000
a
year. Nobody can Nobody can afford that. I'm very grateful for these drugs, but drugs don't work if people can't afford them, and that's why we're having this discussion in the United States today.
Okay, let's be clear about something. When you say those drugs that you're taking cost $325,000 a year, you mean the list price, right? Nobody is paying that price, are they?
Oh, somebody's paying the huge part of that price. The price I see on my explanation of benefits, people with insurance, I think, know what that is, where you get a report on what your treatments cost. The list price showing that my doctor is charging as a starting point for two drugs, those are only two, my two main cancer drugs, is $325,000 a year. Now, the price, while it may be discounted on some drugs where there's competition, there's very little discounting in Medicare Part B for these drugs because there's no competition. So basically, either me or our government, which means us as taxpayers, are paying the overwhelming lion's share of that $325,000 because there's no discounting, because there's no competition.
I think this is a really important part of this that I want to understand better and I want listeners to understand better. Dr. Jalad, when AbbVie says that it sells its drug Humira for the listed price of $60,000 a year, why is sometimes that drug price discounted? Why are other drug prices discounted? And why aren't others? Why are we paying close to the full price for some others? How is this affected?
Yeah, and it's interesting. You started in the first 1 minute with probably the reason why we haven't actually gotten anywhere on pricing is because there's this incredible confusion around what list prices are and what they are not, who faces them and who doesn't face them. This happens often where the list price is quoted, but then somebody says, well, somebody doesn't pay that price, and then everybody gets confused and tunes out. So I like how you've honed in immediately on the most complicated issue. The list price, excuse me, is the price that is set by the companies. And then if there is competition, they will give discounts in the form of these rebates to different insurers in order to get the drug used by those insurers. So it's a discount from this list price in order to get business. And there is no discount then if there's nothing to compete with. There's no way that insurers can ask for rebates, can negotiate rebates. And so that's why this discount will be different for Humira versus Revlimid versus other drugs.
Okay, I think this is important too. So what you're saying is when the pharmaceutical companies look in and assess the market, there are times when, because they want more people to take their drugs, they look at the economics, they look at the competition, and they say, okay, we can sell that drug for a lower price. But sometimes in the market, when there is no competition for a specific drug, then they charge basically what they want. And is that why we see some of these prices on some of these drugs?
Yes, that's exactly right. And the issue, though, is that even for those drugs that have discounts, what's happened in the last 5-10 years is that consumers are facing those costs, are not receiving the benefit of those costs. And that's been part of the discussion, is that when the company gives the insurance company, when the pharmaceutical manufacturer gives the insurer a discount, that insurer gets that rebate, but a patient, your callers who might be in their deductible or have to pay 40% of the price, uh-huh, are often having to pay 40% of that really high price. So that list price, even though there's a discount, many consumers might not face it when they go to the pharmacy.
Okay, let's hear from some of our listeners. We have full phone lines. If you're having trouble getting in on the lines, please call us back. I want to hear your situation. And I'll just make a note here that I don't think we have time this morning to hear your whole story about how the drug prices have gone up and down. I really want to know about how this affects your household budget, the pharmaceutical drugs that you're taking, and then overall, if you have an assessment, an idea about why Congress hasn't done anything about this when Americans have been calling for some kind of action. To the phones to Sonia in Minneapolis. So, Sonia, how does this affect your life and it sounds like your mother's life?
Well, my mother is on Eliquis, which has a price tag that, thank goodness, again, like one of your contributors, she is on a supplement, mm-hmm, which covers most of it, but she goes beyond the donut hole and ends up needing more money. So I actually, as a woman of 57, am supporting my mother through her life because she's desperately afraid of the last remaining amounts that she has from my father's insurance policy when he passed, not covering
out
her expenses.
Yeah. Sonia, what about how much do the drugs that she takes for her cancer treatment cost what it sounds like you per month?
My contribution ends up being close to $500 a month to her lifestyle, you know, being able to pay the rent, being able to offset what she's going to have to pay at the end of the year.
Okay.
So I distribute that out per month. I also have a sister with non-smoking related lung cancer who has been blessed by a targeted chemo pill.
Uh-huh.
She was on for 3.5 years, and it was at least $10,000 a month. And she is on Social Security. She has no income. She can't work. And that drug lasted for 3.5 years. Now she's on another one, and it costs more than $13,000
wow.
a month for one pill.
Sonia, I'm really glad you heard the show. I appreciate you calling in. I want to hear from Bob here in Cohasset. Bob, it sounds like you also are taking a drug that you have to take day to day, and it's costing a lot of money. Yes?
Well, yeah, I'm a type 2 diabetic, and I take slow-acting insulin, but I also take a new drug called Victoza.
Mm-hmm.
And it's extremely effective in controlling my blood sugar, but it's $970 a month, and combine that with the insulin I take, I'm $1,400 a month in drugs to control my diabetes.
Okay,
well,
so
that's a big impact on our budget. I mean, we're
sure.
self-employed, and we have to decide, okay, what bills aren't we going to pay this month so that, you know, I can control my blood sugar.
David, Bob, thank you much. I want to talk about insulin. I really appreciate the call. David, what is your own research and observation showing you about what's happening with insulin? Because we've been hearing about this for several years now. Why is the price going up the way it is?
Before we move to insulin, let me just say that the huge out-of-pockets for people on Medicare Part D, which is the retail drug program, can run to $15,000 a year. And those are for drugs on which there's very little competition. Lots of times there's very little competition because the drug companies have gamed our system to block competitors from coming to market.
And we'll talk about how they do that in a minute, David. I'm glad you brought that up. Go ahead.
In the case of insulin, what has happened, it's a 100-year-old drug. Even the new modern analog insulins are 22 years old. Three companies have managed to corner the global market, literally, for insulin. They moved their prices in lockstep. They have raised the price of insulin 300% over the past 10 years. This is for a drug that is like water for the rest of us. People with type 1 diabetes have to have insulin or they die. And yet these companies have jacked up the price. Yesterday, one of them said that they were going to bring something called an authorized generic to market that would be half the price of the brand. But even at that price, that generic is going to cost seven times as much as the same exact insulin in other developed countries. Americans are really taking a beating because the drug companies charge us so much more than other countries, developed countries, pay for these drugs. And it's wrong. And that's why people are angry, up in arms, and demanding change.
David, you said a second ago that they raised the prices of insulin in lockstep. You're saying that there is some kind of, I mean, usually that would spur some kind of an antitrust investigation. How is it that these drug prices end up going up by the same amount from different companies?
There are investigations underway around the country. And in fact, last week, Congress launched an investigation into the pricing practices of these insulin makers.
Dr. Jalad, one of the things that Congress has been doing individually without some kind of overall regulation, and we're going to talk about that a little later, Minnesota Senator and Democratic presidential candidate Amy Klobuchar is supporting legislation that would prevent drug makers from paying generic drug manufacturers to delay the release of generic brands. So at the moment, the original manufacturer goes to a generic drug company and says, you might have developed a cheaper, more generic, drug like ours, and we want you to hold off putting that out into the marketplace. Is that how it works?
I think that's essentially how it works. And I think there is broad consensus now to do something about those so-called pay-for-delay tactics. That is one of the reasons, for example, in Europe, they're seeing these so-called biosimilars or generic copies of some of these really expensive drugs like Humira way before we are. There is a lot of litigation in the United States and then these arrangements that will delay the entry of these cheaper drugs into the market. So I think that there is, of the many issues that you could address with pricing, I think pay for delay is one of those that's bipartisan and seems to be getting some more traction in terms of doing something about it.
How much, Dr. Gilad, how much negotiating power do insurers or providers have to try to, especially if there's competition, let's say, on a specific drug, to try to bring the price down? Can they use the power of an organization like a large providing organization or an insurer to try to bring that price down? Or doesn't that work?
Yeah, that actually works really well. And many insurers are quite large and do a lot of negotiation. You know, the issue is what's the starting point in your negotiation? So, and your starting point is the list price. So you can bring the price way down, but if you start at a level that's way up, you're still going to end up paying more than most places in the world. So there is a lot of negotiation when there are options, but one issue is that you're starting from a very high level. The other issue is that the system we have in place, sometimes, believe it or not, the negotiation ends up making the more expensive drug more favorable.
Why?
And that is because of this complicated issue of rebates and these discounts that happen for drugs. In some cases, it can be more profitable for an insurance company to use a more expensive drug than the cheaper drug because they get these back-end rebates. And in Medicare, for example, in Part D, because of the way that the government reinsures or backs up the insurance companies that run Part D, there are actually incentives to use higher-priced drugs and the companies make more. So it is in a way built into the system that these negotiations in some cases don't work. In some cases they do. In some cases, they don't.
This is a conversation in the wake of testimony by a group of CEOs from the largest pharmaceutical companies in the country last week. It was overshadowed by the testimony of Michael Cohen, but we didn't want to miss this, and we thought it was a good opportunity to ask what Washington could be doing about high pharmaceutical prices and why they haven't so far. The CEOs were asked to address this. There were a lot of tough question in Congress, and this has been going on for some time. So we asked Dr. Waleed Gilad to join us from the University of Pittsburgh Center for Pharmaceutical Policy and Prescribing, and David Mitchell is with us, founder of Patients for Affordable Drugs. He's also a patient who relies on drugs to fight his blood cancer. And you're going to hear from a pharmaceutical trade group, Robert Zickerbach, is going to join us a little later. He's executive vice president of public affairs for a pharma group. I want to know from you whether the prices of the drugs that you take have an effect on your household budget. And a larger question, why you think Congress hasn't addressed something that in polling, in campaigns, in anecdotal evidence, Americans say they want to be addressed. I'll ask our guests about that, but I want to hear from you as well. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter, at CarrieMPR, where a listener says everyone is paying for higher drug costs. In large part, premiums and deductibles are high because drug costs are high. David, is Christopher on Twitter right about that? We all feel the effect, even if we ourselves aren't taking pharmaceutical drugs, in the premiums that we're paying.
That's absolutely correct. The fact of the matter is that the problem starts with high list prices that are set by the drug companies, and then the way our system is built, everybody downstream can make more off of those high list prices. The pharmacy benefit managers who run your prescription drug insurance programs, the insurers, even doctors and hospitals are frequently paid a percentage markup. The result is that all of us pay more either through our out-of-pocket for deductibles or co-insurance or co-payments, or with higher premiums, or with higher taxes. And even people who get their health insurance through their employers are paying for it, because if your employer has a dollar to spend on your compensation and they have to spend it on higher drug costs, that's a buck that can't go to your paycheck. So one way or another, the only people paying for everything are patients, consumers, and taxpayers.
That is period. Assuming that if they weren't paying higher benefits, they would be passing out raises. I don't know if that's a...
No, I'm saying if they have a dollar to spend to benefit their employee, and they're going to spend that dollar, if they spend it for higher drug costs, then they can't give it to you in your paycheck.
Call here from Brittany in Minneapolis. Hi, Brittany. How are you affected by this?
A year ago, well, I had a cousin that was insulin dependent for a handful of years, and he was a CPA that was self-employed with his own practice. And a year ago, he took his life because he felt that his bills, being insulin dependent and having such a high premium and high deductible due to being self-employed, was such a burden on his family, and he ended up leaving his wife and three kids behind.
Was he a fairly young guy?
He was in his early 50s.
Wow. Do you know what kinds of medications that he was taking?
I don't know the medications that he was on, but he was he had the pump, and he was very insulin dependent. He was hospitalized a handful of times for it, too. And unfortunately, that's not the first person that I know of who I had a client whose son-in-law did the same due to early stage Parkinson's.
I appreciate the call. Thanks, Brittany. To Kara in Melrose. Hi, Kara. How does this affect you?
Mine is more kind of directly with the insurance company that we had.
Yeah.
I have epilepsy, and my body feels that it's kind of special and that generic drugs don't control my seizures.
Mm-hmm.
And so the insurance company said, well, the generic of the brand that you are taking is available, so you should be taking that.
I see.
And I'm like, I had letters from my doctors and all that kind of stuff saying, but that's not going to help her. She's going to have seizures. And the insurance company didn't care. And the med was about $1,200 a month, and we were in debt about $7,600 was the max, I think, that we made it to.
Wow.
And we were finally able to find somebody else that we were able to get the med through. But my husband is on like this worrying that that's going to end someday, you know, that what are we going to do if that company ever goes away.
You actually raised something that I wanted to talk about here. Dr. Jalad, explain how insurers get into the business of a situation like Kara's. Well, you could be taking the generic drug, but since you don't, we've decided we're not going to cover that. Or, patients having to make a decision between a generic and a name brand drug and the huge difference in the prices. How do the insurers get involved in this?
Right. Yeah, and these circumstances can be really difficult, as Kara had explained, for many patients who need particular drugs. The insurance companies are ultimately responsible for managing the costs associated with providing health care. And in one of the ways they do that is by getting people to use drugs that are less expensive when those drugs are just as good. Now, there are circumstances when they may not be just as good, and that can depend on different patients. But that is part of what insurers do, and everyone who has insurance experiences this, understands formularies. You have to try this drug before that drug. These kinds of utilization management strategies have been increasing over time. They're quite common in Medicare, and it's all about controlling the costs. It's all because drugs are expensive, and if there are less expensive alternatives available, then they should be used. But Kara's situation is not unique. Many people have these concerns, and this is one of the concerns in general when we talk about formularies, is that patients will not be able to get the drugs that they need.
So this is the other thing I'm curious about. And we know that many, many other countries, including Canada, regulate the cost of prescription drugs. What do they do about this situation that we've just been talking about, generic versus name brand drug? How deeply do they get involved in that?
Well, it varies across different countries, but many of them, and I think it's in the United States, I don't know if it's 80, 85%, 90% of all drugs are generic at this point. So there's a lot of effort to get people on generics. Okay. In other countries, they do the same thing. In other countries and in some systems within the U.S., there might be a national formulary. So by having the entire country decide that we want someone, we want individuals primarily on one drug versus the other, with caveats, then that can help negotiate a lower price really for everyone. So that's one of the ways how these other countries can manage prices. I want to say, can I say one thing I think is really important is that it's so important to hear stories like this from your callers and stories that David's group also helps us hear about. One of the things you mentioned, the testimony last week by the CEOs, and to a T, all of them had mentioned how they had had a relative or someone in their family who had benefited from a new innovative drug, which is important, which is part of the story. But the other part is what we're hearing from these callers, and I think that we need to hear more of, is the flip side, is what happens to real patients when their drug costs are too high. So I wanted to make sure I mentioned that and how important it is to hear those stories.
No, I think when Robert Zirkelbach joins us in a couple of minutes, he's going to remind us that these drugs, I mean, we're hearing this from listeners. They're life-saving. We couldn't live the quality of life that we have without them. David, I think the puzzling part of this are these increases year to year and the fact that the United States remains, it seems, fairly alone in paying the full price or being at the mercy, maybe I should say, of pharmaceutical companies deciding to charge what they want to charge. Fair way to put that or not? Robert may take some issue with that, but what would you say?
Well, first of all, I want to make sure to say that innovation in new drug development is critically important. It's critically important for patients like me. I'm relapsing right now for the second time with this incurable blood cancer I have. I need them to invent new drugs or I'm going to die sooner than I want to. And that's not theoretical. It's an absolute fact. But we need to make sure we're incentivizing innovation in new drug development and ensure that when those drugs come to market, that they are affordable and that they are accessible. Last week in that hearing before the Senate Finance Committee, those drug company CEOs, all seven, acknowledged that they benefit from taxpayer investment in the basic science to develop new drugs and that no country in the world contributes more to that new science to develop new drugs than we do, and yet we pay the highest prices in the world. Why? One of the main reasons, to go to your question, is that we are the only nation in the world that doesn't negotiate directly with the drug companies. Every other country in the world negotiates directly with the companies, and they wind up paying 30 to 40% of what we pay. We need direct negotiations by Medicare with the drug companies in order to bring down prices more in line with what people in other nations pay, especially because we as a nation are contributing so much to the innovation that is bringing these life-saving drugs to market.
Bringing Robert Zirkelbach in, he's Executive Vice President of Public Affairs for the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, also known as Pharma, with us from D.C. Robert, welcome. Good to have you listening on the air or on the show for a while, and I'm glad to have you on the air. Thanks.
Great. Thanks for having me on today.
You hear a lot of puzzlement and confusion and, dare I say, some frustration with the price of drugs. And the question is, why is it that pharmaceutical companies are raising these prices year over year over year when other countries regulate and manage these prices? Why do the pharmaceutical companies need to charge what they're charging in the United States alone?
Well, I'm glad that you're having this discussion today, and we understand why patients are frustrated. They should be. You know, our healthcare system treats medicines different than they treat any other healthcare service. If you're a patient, you will get care at a hospital or in a physician's office. You're going to pay your out-of-pocket cost based on a negotiated rate. But if you go to the pharmacy counter, you have to pay the full price for a medicine, even if your insurance company gets a very big discount. And in the case of insulin that you talked about earlier, those discounts can be as high as 70%. And so you have situations where patients' out-of-pocket costs are increasing every single year for medicines, when the amount that insurance companies are paying for medicines has been flat the last couple of years. And so we've got to make sure that when there are negotiated discounts and savings happening in a marketplace, it's actually benefiting patients.
But
they're seeing their costs go up and they're frustrated.
But Robert,
and we need to
some of this absolutely has to come back to the pharmaceutical companies themselves, the very companies that you represent in this trade group. Why are they raising the prices year over year? I'm seeing in some cases 100-200% increases over like 3 years. So some of this has got to come back to the doorstep of the pharmaceutical companies. And what justifies price increases like that?
Well, absolutely. And there's a lot of factors that go into why the price of a medicine may increase
or
decrease.
Give me a couple of them so I can understand this. Give me a few of those factors.
Even after a medicine comes on the marketplace, pharmaceutical companies continue to do more research on that medicine to learn more about which patients it can help, which diseases it can be effective in. But the prices are also negotiated with insurance companies and these pharmacy benefit managers that you talked about earlier in the segment.
But the benefit managers, Robert, just if I might, the benefit managers are not going back to the people that Johnson & Johnson, let's say, and saying, hey, you know what? If you increase the price of that drug by 55%, that would be fine with us. These are decisions that are being made within the companies themselves. And I want to ask you, isn't a lot of the money, even though you mentioned the research that goes on, isn't a lot of the money spent on marketing, on the television commercials that we see?
Well, I think the amount of money that companies spend on marketing and promotion activities are greatly exaggerated. Our companies spend vastly more on research and development. So last year, on average, our companies spent $70 billion every year researching and developing new medicines. The amount of money that goes to TV advertising is around $4 or $5 billion. I mean, no other industry in America spends more in researching and developing medicines. But we do need to look at the entire supply chain. Because a lot of the higher prices that patients are paying are going to pay for really big rebates that are going to insurance companies and PBMs. So the last couple of years, last 3 years in a row now, the amount of money that insurance companies, the prices insurance companies are paying for medicines have been roughly growing the rate of inflation. But the amount that patients are paying is going up every single year. So we can't address the issue if we don't actually look at where the money's going. And a large part of it is going to these middlemen in the system. And that's exactly why you were seeing the administration, policymakers at the federal and state levels looking at reforming the rebate system so that patients are actually benefiting when prices are being lowered for medicine.
I have another question about the research, and then I'm going to ask Dr. Gilad if he has a view on this. Isn't much of the research that pharmaceutical companies benefit from, it isn't all done just within these labs that the pharmaceutical companies own. Isn't a lot of the research filtering in from universities, and pharmaceutical companies are benefiting from that? But then when it comes time to acknowledge that they have benefited from this, what is essentially public research, that doesn't seem to be taken into account when they decide what they're going to charge for the drug. First, is that true about research coming in from universities and other public entities? I'm asking you, Robert. No, I'm sorry. I'm asking you that first. No, sorry about that.
No, a lot of research is done in academic settings and usually in partnership with pharmaceutical companies. A lot of that research is actually funded by pharmaceutical companies that we do in partnership with academic medical centers, with universities. And when a medicine does come to market as a result of that research, universities actually get a lot of royalties from that. They do benefit from the sale of those medicines. It's an important ecosystem. We need all players working together, the great work that's done at NIH, the great work that's done at academia, and of course the work that's being done in the pharmaceutical industry to actually take medicines and bring them to market to make sure that patients can benefit from them.
Dr. Gilad, is that something that should make more of a difference than it does? I mean, is it even an important factor in this or not?
I think The issue around research and development and the role of academia is important. And like everything, and I don't want to preface everything I say, like everything, it's complicated. I have a lot of sympathy. I have some sympathy for the pharmaceutical industry position here. The system does encourage rebates. The industry is pushing for a system without rebates in which there can be some transparency. But the way that I think about this entire problem, and this is not to say anything about Robert in particular, but it's like a bunch of siblings who are arguing. Okay, every side, the insurance company is saying it's pharma, pharma is saying it's PBM, PBM say, and what you need is an adult in the room. And in this case, the adult is government. And so there are various proposals to address this and bring the groups together. The bottom line, fundamental disagreement is the first thing that I think, and I think Robert had brought up, is this issue of innovation. The fundamental problem is that we constantly come back that if we lower prices, that we will not get the drugs we need in the future to save our lives. And that is a debatable issue. And the question is, how much can you lower prices to an extent that is okay and that you will still get the amount of innovation you want 10, 20 years from now? And that's why we can't figure out what the answer is. It's this sibling infighting because everybody, like a sibling, everybody's in a family. Everybody needs everybody else to make money, but there's disagreement. And so it is very hard to figure out what the solution is when each side blames the other.
David, do you have a view on that?
Yeah. First of all, hi, Robert. The drug companies, with all due respect to Robert, inflate their claims of R&D. Last week, at the Senate Finance Committee hearing, the CEO of AbbVie said that it spent $50 billion from 2013 to 2018 on R&D. Bloomberg Law checked that figure, fact-checked it. It was $25 billion, half of what was claimed. We definitely want to invest in research and development. We do as a nation. The budget for NIH, the National Institutes of Health, this year is $39 billion. We also have foundations and academic institutions that receive tax-advantaged grants that are on top of that. And then pharma claims $70 billion in R&D. The point of all this is that if we make the investment as a nation and we invest more than any other country in the world in the basic science that leads to these drugs, why do we pay the highest prices? It makes no sense whatsoever. We're already making the largest investment. We should be getting credit for that. But that's not the way it works. The way it works is that the drug companies have monopoly pricing power. They use it to price the drugs as high as they can without regard for how much we invested to bring it to market, or whether it's going to encourage affordability and accessibility for patients.
Now,
and that's
now,
what's wrong.
I want to give Robert a chance to respond to that, and then I have a question. Robert, go ahead. What do you want to add?
I think this is an important discussion about what we pay versus prices in other countries. As we've talked about in this show, the innovation coming on the marketplace today is the most exciting that we've ever seen. At the break, we were talking about a functional cure for HIV.
Mm-hmm.
We're seeing groundbreaking treatments in cancer. There was the first gene therapy approved that's literally giving children their sight back. And that innovation is happening here in the U.S. because we have a system that supports and sustains and rewards innovation. Other countries do often pay less for medicines, and they do that for two reasons. One is they just steal the innovations that are happening here in the U.S., and we've got to do a better job of cracking down on that. And this administration's done more than any other administration through stronger trade agreements to make sure we're leveling the playing field. The other thing they do is they just limit access to those treatments. Patients get access to the newest, most innovative medicines in the United States. And many of the other countries we're talking about, the government just says no. And they either don't get access or they have to wait years for those treatments. So we need to make sure that we're putting this debate into context. If you get sick, if you have cancer, you want to be in the United States, being able to have access to these innovative treatments. We need to do a better job. I'm not here saying that we think current
Robert,
system is working
but,
well.
By the way, you know, that's the same argument that we get when we talk about reforming our healthcare system. And people say, well, it's the best healthcare in the world. It's not. We know that by outside analysis of the quality of the healthcare we get here. Are you saying that if there is some kind of regulation that government finally creates that, what, people are not going to get their cancer treated, that they're not going to get the drugs that they need? I don't think that kind of what I think of as kind of fear mongering is really appropriate in the kind of conversation we're having.
And that's not at all what I've been saying, and last week. What we've said is that we think the system does need to change. It's not working well for patients, and there are important reforms that we could make that would make medicines much more affordable and accessible for patients. Rebate reform is a great place to start. That's going to be incredibly disruptive for our industry. We have to completely change how we negotiate with insurance companies and PBMs. We think it's the right thing to do for patients, because right now the negotiated savings aren't making their way to patients at the pharmacy counter. We think that's just one of a number of changes that need to happen. So we hope that there is action that will reform the system and make it easier for patients to be able to get the medicines that they need. But we need to make sure it's the right types of reforms that won't cause the problems to happen that you just talked about.
Dr. Gilad, what would happen if, let's say, Bernie Sanders ended up being elected in 2020 and he was able to push through his bill for the importation of drugs from Canada? We know individual Americans buy it, Minnesotans buy drugs in Canada. But what would it mean if it was legislated on a larger basis, to what Robert just said about the kind of reform that the pharmaceutical trade group supports?
Yeah, I will avoid predicting what might happen if Sanders wins the election. But I think there is support, including from your senator, around importation, bipartisan
right.
support among personal importation. And I think in a bill last year, if I remember correctly, the CBO had scored that would save money. There's some concern that drugs won't be available in Canada. There's some complications and that Canadian pharmacies aren't going to take U.S. prescriptions. There's a lot of reasons why it might not work, although there's a lot of reasons why it might work. But I think in general, importation, I think, is one of those bipartisan issues that is of interest in Congress. Importation, like I mentioned, pay for delay. That is not going to be a wholesale solution to the problem we have at all. But it is, for some people, maybe a great solution if it's feasible.
Robert, I thought I would take a call or two while you're on with us. Are you good with that?
Sure.
Okay. To Amy in White Bear Lake. Hi, Amy.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment about patient access to medications.
Mm-hmm.
The current guest was speaking, about how our system encourages innovation and, rewards that innovation and gets, access to patients. And I strongly, as a nurse who works with patients who can't afford their medications all the time, I strongly disagree with that comment, because mm-hmm. affordability is one of the key factors in access. So simply because you sell a hugely overpriced drug in the United States doesn't mean that patients actually have access to it. So a meaningful conversation about accessibility should absolutely include affordability.
Robert, do you want to?
Well, and
yeah.
Yeah,
I'm sorry,
I
if I could just.
I
Robert,
think,
you go.
Yeah, Robert, go ahead.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. We have to do more to make sure that patients can be able to afford the medicines that they need. And that's why we've been saying throughout this whole program that we need to find a way to lower costs for patients at the pharmacy. And what your listener should know is that if patients are struggling to be able to afford their medicine, every single manufacturer of medicines offers a program to provide those patients with financial assistance. That's not the best solution to our healthcare system, but our companies offer those programs, and people should know that they're available, that they can go to the manufacturer, they can go to the Partnership for Prescription Assistance. It's PPARX.org. You can actually search by medicine to find out which assistance programs might be available.
But
for
as
you.
I think you began your answer, you're saying that's really not the solution to this. You're saying that's part of a small part of a remedy.
It does not fix the problem, but it is a stopgap that our companies are doing to try to help people while we try to find larger structural reforms that actually lower costs for patients at the pharmacy.
David,
I think that's the biggest challenge that we've had in this conversation, is so many of the proposals out there would lower costs for the government, they would lower costs for insurance companies. We've got to make sure that any proposals that move forward actually lower costs for patients when they go to the pharmacy to get a medicine.
David, briefly, if you will, because I want to grab another call.
Yep, real quick. We don't think patients should have to go beg drug companies in order to get largesse. We think we should fix the system, as Robert suggests, so that drugs are affordable to begin with. And also, It's important to note that one of the main reasons drugs are first available in the U.S. is because drug companies come here first to seek approval, because we are the highest paying, largest market in the world. So when they say, gosh, you guys won't get those drugs you need, well, that's not exactly true.
Listener on Twitter says, I'm a 911 dispatcher. Taxpayers pay tertiary costs, caring for those that can't afford medications, ambulance rides, office time, not just diabetics. There's no excuse for what's happening. To the phones to Terry in Edina. Hi, Terry. Kind of short on time, but I really wanted to get to your call. What did you want to say?
Well, I think there's two things that jump out at me. First of all, I have a granddaughter who was diagnosed at age one with juvenile rheumatoid arthritis. She's now 13. Oh. And for her medications, she receives an infusion every 5 weeks. And the billing price on that infusion is $22,600 and some.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. How much do her parents pay? Do you know?
I do. They pay $6,000 as a deductible. For the first treatment at the beginning of the year.
Okay.
And, you know, right now they're lucky because their insurance covers that. Every time they have to switch her drugs because something's not working anymore, they have to go to battle. And meanwhile, she sits there without medications, allowing her to be able to participate in life.
Mm.
Every time the new year comes around and they have to pay that deductible, it's a hardship. She's not their only child. If they change a job and their insurance changes, then they have to go to battle again. What's interesting to me is that that means that that billing price on that drug a year for her is about $225,000.
Yeah, wow.
There are 300,000 kids in this country who have juvenile rheumatoid arthritis. Even if only one third of them need this kind of drug, that's an amazing cost going to the pharmaceutical company.
Terry, if I might, I'm going to ask Dr. Jalad for some thoughts on your story on this. Dr. Jalad, what occurs to you on that?
Yeah, again, it's a remarkable story, and it's the kind of story we need to hear more. I think that this comes down to affordability, and the issue is affordability depends partly on how much insurance pays, which I think is an argument Robert makes and pharma has made, but partly on the price. And both of those things, how much the service costs and how much patients have to pay because of that price, matter. And, you know, these infusions, these therapies that have remarkable ability to help patients, they are only going to multiply in the future. They are all going to be expensive. And we have a reckoning. And I know people maybe have said this in healthcare for a while, but
yeah.
We are going to have to do something about the cost of these therapies.
Robert, I was just going to ask you real quickly with a minute left, if you do feel we've reached kind of the Rubicon on the way these drug prices are set and what we pay. Something is going to change. Is that the sense of the industry?
We hope so. And we recognize the system needs to change, and we want to be part of the solution.
I really appreciate you being with us and listening in as much as you did and then joining us. Thank you.
Thanks for having me on.
Robert Zirkelback with us from a pharmaceutical trade group. David, thank you very much for being part of it. I wish you well in your treatment, and I'm glad you're fighting on the issue. Thank you.
Thank you, Carrie, very, very much.
And Dr. Jalad?
Dr. Jalad.
Yeah, absolutely.
Robert, too.
Dr. Jalad, thank you from the University of Pittsburgh Center for Pharmaceutical Policy and Prescribing. Good to have you as part of the show.
Thanks for having me.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to the discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet us at @CarrieNPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all our shows by subscribing to this podcast. You can send us your questions or comments by emailing talk@npr.org.